in were named Haska, Merrick, Quasar, Zak, Razda, Gazin, Paul, even Resnek and Lorek. What am I to do with a list of names?
Every man on that list has kin within the city, sons and brothers, wives and daughters, mothers and fathers. Let my brazen beast seize them. Their lives will win you back those ships.
If I send the brazen beasts into the pyramids, it will mean open war inside the city. I have no trust in Histar. I have to hope for peace. Danny held the parchment above a candle and watched the names go up in flame, while Skahaz glowered at her. Afterwards, Sir Barristan told her that her brother Rhaegar would have been proud of her. Danny remembered the words Sir Jorah had spoken at Astabor. Rhaegar fought valiantly. Rhaegar fought nobly. Rhaegar fought honourably. And Rhaegar died. When she descended to the purple marble hall, she found it almost empty.
"Are there no petitioners today?" Danny asked Resnek Bo Resnek. "No one who craves justice or silver for a sheep."
"No, your worship. The city is afraid."
"There's nothing to fear."
But there was much and more to fear, as she learned that evening. As her young hostages, Miklas and Kesmir, were laying out a simple supper of autumn greens and ginger soup for her, Iri came to tell her that Galazi Galari had returned, with three blue graces from the temple.
"Grey Worm is come as well, Khaleesi. They beg words with you most urgently. Bring them to my hall and summon Resnek and Skahaz. Did the Green Grace say what this was about?"
"Astapor," said Iri. Grey Worm began the tale.
"He came out of the morning mists, a rider on a pale horse, dying. His mare was staggering as she approached the city gates, her sides pink with blood and lather, her eyes rolling with terror. Her rider called out, 'She is burning! She is burning!' and fell from the saddle. This one was sent for and gave orders that the rider be brought to the Blue Graces. When your servants carried him inside the gates, he cried out again, 'She is burning!' Under his toka, he was a skeleton, all bones and fevered flesh."
One of the Blue Graces took up the tale from there.
"The Unsullied brought this man to the temple, where we stripped him and bathed him in cool water. His clothes were soiled, and my sisters found half an arrow in his thigh. Though he had broken off the shaft, the head remained inside him, and the wound had mortified, filling him with poisons. He died within the hour, still crying out that she was burning."
"She is burning," Daenerys repeated. "Who is she?"
"Astapor, your radiance," said another of the Blue Graces. "He said it once. He said, 'Astapor is burning.' It might have been his fever talking."
"Your radiance speaks wisely," said Galazar Galari. "But Azara saw something else."
The Blue Grace called Azara folded her hands.
"My queen," she murmured, "his fever was not brought on by the arrow. He had soiled himself, not once, but many times. The stains reached to his knees, and there was dried blood amongst his excrement. His horse was bleeding," Grey Worm said.
"This thing is true, your grace," the eunuch confirmed. "The pale mare was bloody from his spur."
"That may be so, your radiance," said Azara. "But this blood was mingled with his stool. It stained his small clothes."
"He was bleeding from the bowels," said Galazza Galari.
"We cannot be certain," said Azara, "but it may be that Meereen has more to fear than the spears of the Yunkai." "We must pray," said the Green Grace. "The God sent this man to us. He comes as a harbinger. He comes as a sign."
A sign of what?" asked Danny.
"A sign of wrath and ruin."
She did not want to believe that.
He was one man. One sick man with an arrow in his leg. A horse brought him here. Not a god.
A pale mare.
Danny rose abruptly.
I thank you for your counsel, and for all that you did for this poor man.
The Green Grace kissed Danny's fingers before she took her leave.
We shall pray for Estepor.
And for me. Oh, pray for me, my lady. If Estepor had fallen, nothing remained to prevent Yunkai from turning north. She turned to Sir Barristan.
Send riders into the hills to find my blood riders. Recall Brown Ben and the Second Sons as well. And the Storm Crows, Your Grace?
Dario.
Yes, yes.
Just 3 nights ago she had dreamt of Dario lying dead beside the road, staring sightlessly into the sky as crows quarreled above his corpse. Other nights she tossed in her bed, imagining that he had betrayed her, as he had once betrayed his fellow captains in the Storm Crows.
He brought me their heads.
What if he had taken his company back to Yunkai, to sell her for a pot of gold?
He would not do that, would he?
The Storm Crows, too. Send riders after them at once. The Second Sons were the first to return, 8 days after the Queen sent forth her summons. When Sir Barristan told her that her captain desired words with her, she thought for a moment that it was Dario, and her heart leapt. But the captain that he spoke of was Brown Ben Plum. Brown Ben had a seamed and weathered face, skin the colour of old teak, white hair, and wrinkles at the corners of his eyes. Danny was so pleased to see his leathery brown face that she hugged him. His eyes crinkled in amusement.
"I heard talk Your Grace was going to take a husband," he said. "But no one told me it was me."
They laughed together as Resnick sputtered. But the laughter ceased when Brown Ben said,
"We caught 3 Astapori. Your worship had best hear what they say. Bring them."
Daenerys received them in the grandeur of her hall, as tall candles burned amongst the marble pillars. When she saw that the Astapori were half-starved, she sent for food at once. These 3 were all that remained of a dozen who had set out together from the Red City, a bricklayer, a weaver, and a cobbler.
"What befell the rest of your party?" the Queen asked.
"Slain," said the cobbler. "Yunkai sell swords, roam the hills north of Astapor, hunting down those who flee the flames."
"Has the city fallen, then? Its walls were thick."
"This is so," said the bricklayer, a stoop-backed man with rheumy eyes. "But they were old and crumbling as well."
The weaver raised her head.
"Every day we told each other that the Dragon Queen was coming back."
The woman had thin lips and dull, dead eyes, set in a pinched and narrow face.
"Cleon had sent for you, it was said, and you were coming."
"He sent for me," thought Danny.
"Well, that much is true, at least."
"Outside our walls, the Yunkai devoured our crops and slaughtered our herds," the cobbler went on. "Inside, we starved. We ate cats and rats and leather. A horse hide was a feast. King Cutthroat and Queen Whore accused each other of feasting on the flesh of the slain. Men and women gathered in secret to draw lots and gorge upon the flesh of him who drew the black stone. The pyramid of Naklos was despoiled and set aflame by those who claimed that Krasny's Mo Naklos was to blame for all our woes."
"Others blamed Daenerys," said the weaver, "but more of us still loved you. She is on her way," we said to one another. "She is coming at the head of a great host with food for all." "I can scarce feed my own folk. If I had marched to Astapor, I would have lost Meereen."
The cobbler told them how the body of the Butcher King had been disinterred and clad in copper armour, after the Green Grace of Astapor had a vision that he would deliver them from the Yunkai. Armoured and stinking, the corpse of Cleon the Great was strapped onto the back of a starving horse to lead the remnants of his new Unsullied on a sortie. But they rode right into the iron teeth of a legion from New Gith and were cut down to a man. Afterward, the Green Grace was impaled upon a stake in the Plaza of Punishment and left until she died. In the Pyramid of Ulor, the survivors had a great feast that lasted half the night, and washed the last of their food down with poison wine, so none need wake again come morning. Soon after came the sickness, a bloody flux that killed 3 men of every 4, until a mob of dying men went mad and slew the guards on the main gate. The old brickmaker broke in to say,
"No, that was the work of healthy men running to escape the flux."
"Does it matter?" asked the cobbler. "The guards were torn apart and the gates thrown open. The legions of New Gis came pouring into Astabor, followed by the Yunkai and the sellswords on their horses. Queen Hor died fighting them, with a curse upon her lips. King Cutthroat yielded and was thrown into a fighting pit to be torn apart by a pack of starving dogs."
"Even then some said you were coming," said the weaver. "They swore that they'd seen you mounted on a dragon, flying high above the camps of the Yunkai. Every day we looked for you."
"I could not come," the queen thought. "I dare not."
"And when the city fell," demanded Skarhaz, "what then?"
"The butchery began. The Temple of the Graces was full of the sick, who had come to ask the gods to heal them. The legions sealed the doors and set the temple ablaze with torches. Within the hour, fires were burning in every corner of the city. As they spread, they joined with one another. The streets were full of mobs, running this way and that, to escape the flames. But there was no way out. The Yunkai held the gates."
"Yet you escaped," the shave pate said. "How is that?"
The old man answered,
"I am by trade. A brickmaker, as my father and his father were before me. My grandfather built our house up against the city walls. It was an easy thing to work loose a few bricks every night. When I told my friends, they helped me shore up the tunnel so it would not collapse. We all agreed that it might be good to have our own way out."
"I left you with a council to rule over you," Danny thought. "A healer, a scholar, and a priest." She could still recall the Red City as she had first seen it, dry and dusty behind its red brick walls, dreaming cruel dreams, yet full of life.
"There were islands in the Worm where lovers kissed, but in the Plaza of Punishment they peeled the skin off men in strips and left them hanging naked for the flies. It is good that you have come," she told the Astapori. "You will be safe in Merin."
The cobbler thanked her for that, and the old brickmaker kissed her foot. But the weaver looked at her with eyes as hard as slate.
"She knows I lie," the queen thought. "She knows I cannot keep them safe. Astapor is burning, and Merin is next."
"There's more coming," Bronwyn announced, when the Astapori had been led away. "These 3 had horses. Most are afoot."
"How many are they?"
asked Resnick.
Brown Ben shrugged. "Hundreds? Thousands. Some sick, some burned, some wounded. The cats and the windblown are swarming through the hills with lance and lash, driving them north and cutting down the laggards. Mouths on feet, and sick, you say?"
Resnick wrung his hands.
"Your worship must not allow them in the city."
"I wouldn't," said Brown Ben Plum. "I'm no maester, mind you, but I know you got to keep the bad apples from the good."
"These are not apples, Ben," said Danny. "These are men and women, sick and hungry and afraid. My children. I should have gone to Astapor."
"Your grace could not have saved them," said Sir Barristan. "You warned King Cleon against this war with Yunkai. The man was a fool, and his hands were red with blood."
And are my hands any cleaner?
She remembered what Dario had said, that all kings must be butchers or meat.
Cleon was the enemy of our enemy. If I had joined him at the horns of Hasset, we might have crushed the Yunkai between us.
The Shavepate disagreed. If you had taken the Unsullied south to Hasset, the sons of the Harpy...
I know. It is Aroa all over again.
Brown Ben Plum was puzzled. Who is Aroa?
A girl I thought I'd saved from rape and torment. All I did was make it worse for her in the end. And all I did in Astapor was make 10,000 Aroids.
Your Grace could not have known.
I am the Queen. It was my place to know.
What is done, said Resnick Mo Resnick. Your Worship, I beg you, take the noble Hesdar for your king at once. He can speak with the wise masters. Make a peace for us.
On what terms? Beware the perfume seneschal, Quaith had said.
The Mars woman had foretold the coming of the pale mare. Was she right about the noble Resnick, too?
I may be a young girl innocent of war, but I'm not a lamb to walk bleating into the harpy's den. I still have my Unsullied. I have the Stormcrows and the Second Sons. I have three companies of freedmen.
Them and dragons, said Brown Ben Plum, with a grin. In the pit, in chains, wailed Resnick Mo Resnick. What good are dragons that cannot be controlled? Even the Unsullied grew fearful when they must open the doors to feed them.
What of the Queen's little pets?
Brown Ben's eyes crinkled in amusement. The grizzled captain of the Second Sons was a creature of the Free Companies, a mongrel with the blood of a dozen different peoples flowing through his veins. But he had always been fond of the dragons, and them of him.
"Pets!" screeched Resnick. "Monsters, rather! Monsters that feed on children! We cannot—"
"Silence," said Daenerys. "We will not speak of that."
Resnick shrank away from her, flinching from the fury in her tone.
"Forgive me, Magnificence, I did not—"
Brown Ben Plum bawled over him.
"Your Grace, the Yunkish, got three free companies against our two. And there's talk the Yunkish men sent to Volantis to fetch back the Golden Company. Those bastards field 10,000. Yunkai's got four Giscari legions, too, maybe more. And I heard it said they sent riders across the Dothraki Sea to maybe bring some big Khalasar down on us. We need them dragons, the way I see it."
Danny sighed.
"I'm sorry, Ben. I dare not loose the dragons."
She could see that was not the answer that he wanted. Plum scratched at his speckled whiskers.
"If there's no dragons in the balance, well, we should leave before them Yunkish bastards close the trap. Only first make the slavers pay to see our backs. They pay the Khals to leave their cities be. Why not us? Sell Meereen back to them, and start west with wagons full of gold and gems and such."
"You want me to loot Meereen and flee?"
"No, I will not do that. Grey Worm, are my freedmen ready for battle?"
The eunuch crossed his arms against his chest.
"They are not Unsullied, but they will not shame you. This one will swear to that by spear and sword, Your Worship."
Good, that's good.
Daenerys looked at the faces of the men around her, the Shavepate scowling, Sir Barristan with his lined face and sad blue eyes, Resnick Mo Resnick, pale, sweating, Bron Ben, white-haired, grizzled, tough as old leather, Grey Worm, smooth-cheeked, stolid, expressionless.
"Dario should be here, and my blood riders," she thought. "If there is to be battle, the blood of my blood should be with me."
She missed Sir Jorah Mormont, too.
"He lied to me, informed on me, but he loved me, too. and he always gave good counsel.
I defeated the young Kay before. I will defeat them again.
Where, though? How?
You mean to take the field?
The shave-pate's voice was thick with disbelief.
That would be folly. Our walls are taller and thicker than the walls of Astapor, and our defenders are more valiant. The Yunkai will not take this city easily.
Sir Barristan disagreed.
I do not think we should allow them to invest us. Theirs is a patchwork host at best. These slavers are no soldiers. If we take them unawares...
Small chance of that, the shave-pate said. The Yunkai have many friends inside the city. They will know.
How large an army can we muster?
Danny asked.
Not large enough, begging your royal pardon, said Bran Ben Plum. What does Naharis have to say? If we're going to make a fight of this, we need his stormcrows.
Dario is still in the field.
Oh, gods, what have I done? Have I sent him to his death? Ben, I will need your second sons to scout our enemies. Where they are, how fast they are advancing, how many men they have, and how they are disposed.
We'll need provisions. Fresh horses, too.
Of course. Sir Barristan will see to it.
Bran Ben scratched his chin.
Might be we could get someone to come over. If your grace could spare a few bags of gold and gems, just to give their captains a good taste, as it were.
Well, who knows?
Buy them. Why not?
Danny said. That sort of thing went on all the time amongst the free companies of the disputed land, she knew.
Yes, very good. Resnick, see to it. Once the second sons ride out, close the gates and double the watch upon the walls.
It shall be done, magnificence, said Resnick, Mo Resnick. What of these Astapori?
My children, they are coming here for help, for succor and protection. We cannot turn our backs on them.
Sir Barristan frowned.
Your Grace, I have known the bloody flux to destroy whole armies when left to spread unchecked. The Seneschal is right. We cannot have the Astapori in Meereen.
Danny looked at him helplessly. It was good the dragons did not cry.
As you say, then, we will keep them outside the walls until this curse has run its course. Set up a camp for them beside the river, west of the city. We will send them what food we can. Perhaps we can separate the healthy from the sick.
All of them were looking at her.
Will you make me say it twice? Go and do as I've commanded you.
Danny rose, brushed past Bran Ben, and climbed the steps to the sweet solitude of her terrace. 200 leagues divided Meereen from Astapor, yet it seemed to her that the sky was darker to the southwest, smudged and hazy with the smoke of the red cities passing.
Brick and blood built Astapor, and brick and blood its people.
The old rhyme rang in her head.
Ash and bone is Astapor, and ash and bone its people.
She tried to recall Eroa's face, but the dead girl's features kept turning into smoke. When Daenerys finally turned away, Sir Barristan stood near her, wrapped in his white cloak against the chill of evening.
Can we make a fight of this? She asked him.
Men can always fight, Your Grace. Ask rather if we can win. Dying is easy, but victory comes hard. Your freedmen are half-trained and unblooded. Your sailswords once served your foes, and once a man turns his cloak, he will not scruple to turn it again. You have 2 dragons who cannot be controlled, and a 3rd that may be lost to you. And beyond these walls, your only friends are the Lazarine, who have no taste for war. My walls are strong, though, no stronger than when we sat outside them, and the sons of the Harpy are inside the walls with us. So are the great masters, both those you did not kill and the sons of those you did.
I know, the queen sighed. What do you counsel, sir?
"Battle," said Sir Barristan. "Meereen is overcrowded and full of hungry mouths, and you have too many enemies within. We cannot long withstand a siege, I fear. Let me meet the foe as he comes north, on ground of my own choosing."
"Meet the foe," she echoed, "with the freedmen you've called half-trained and unblooded?"
"We were all unblooded once, Your Grace. The unsullied will help stiffen them. If I had 500 knights,
or 5, and if I give you the unsullied, I will have no one but the brazen beast to hold Meereen."
When Sir Barristan did not dispute her, Danny closed her eyes.
"Gods," she prayed, "you took Khal Drogo, who was my sun and stars. You took our valiant son before he drew a breath. You have had your blood of me. Help me now, I pray you. Give me the wisdom to see the path ahead and the strength to do what I must do to keep my children safe."
The gods did not respond. When she opened her eyes again, Daenerys said,
"I cannot fight 2 enemies, one within and one without. If I am to hold Meereen, I must have the city behind me, the whole city. I need...
She could not say it. "Your Grace," Sir Barristan prompted, gently.
"A queen belongs not to herself, but to her people. I need Hisdar Zolorik."
Melisandre. It was never truly dark in Melisandre's chambers. 3 tallow candles burned upon her windowsill to keep the terrors of the night at bay. 4 more flickered beside her bed, 2 to either side. In the hearth a fire was kept burning day and night. The first lesson those who would serve her had to learn was that the fire must never, ever be allowed to go out. The Red Priestess closed her eyes and said a prayer, then opened them once more to face the hearth fire. "One more time," she had to be certain. Many a priest and priestess before her had been brought down by false visions, by seeing what they wished to see instead of what the Lord of Light had sent. Stannis was marching south into peril. The king who carried the fate of the world upon his shoulders, Azor Ahai reborn. Surely R'hllor would vouchsafe her a glimpse of what awaited him. "Show me Stannis, Lord," she prayed. "Show me your king, your instrument." Visions danced before her, gold and scarlet, flickering, forming and melting, and dissolving into one another, shapes strange and terrifying and seductive. She saw the eyeless faces again, staring out at her from sockets weeping blood. Then the towers by the sea, crumbling as the dark tide came sweeping over them, rising from the depths. Shadows in the shape of skulls, skulls that turned to mist, bodies locked together in lust, writhing and rolling and clawing. Through curtains of fire, great winged shadows wheeled against a hard blue sky. "The girl, I must find the girl again, the grey girl on the dying horse." Jon Snow would expect that of her, and soon. It would not be enough to say the girl was fleeing. He would want more. He would want the when and where, and she did not have that for him. She had seen the girl only once. "A girl as grey as ash, and even as I watched, she crumbled and blew away." A face took shape within the hearth. "Stannis?" she thought, just for a moment. But no, these were not his features. A wooden face, corpse white. Was this the enemy? 1,000 red eyes floated in the rising flames. "He sees me." Beside him, a boy with a wolf's face threw back his head and howled. The Red Priestess shuddered. Blood trickled down her thigh, black and smoking. The fire was inside her, an agony, an ecstasy, filling her, searing her, transforming her. Shimmers of heat traced patterns on her skin. insistent as a lover's hand. Strange voices called to her from days long past.
"Melanie!"
she heard a woman cry. A man's voice called, "Lot 7!" She was weeping, and her tears were flame, and still she drank it in. Snowflakes swirled from a dark sky, and ashes rose to meet them, the grey and the white whirling around each other as flaming arrows arced above a wooden wall, and dead things shambled silent through the cold, beneath a great grey cliff where fires burned inside 100 caves. Then the wind rose, and the white mist came sweeping in impossibly cold, and one by one the fires went out. Afterward, only the skulls remained.
"Death," thought Melisandre. "The skulls are death."
The flames crackled softly, and in their crackling she heard the whispered name, John Snow. His long face floated before her, limned in tongues of red and orange, appearing and disappearing again. A shadow half seen behind a fluttering curtain. Now he was a man, now a wolf, now a man again. But the skulls were here as well. The skulls were all around him. Melisandre had seen his danger before, had tried to warn the boy of it. Enemies all around him, daggers in the dark. He would not listen. Unbelievers never listened, until it was too late.
"What do you see, my lady?"
the boy asked softly.
"Skulls, 1,000 skulls, and the bastard boy again, John Snow."
Whenever she was asked what she saw within her fires, Melisandre would answer, "Much and more." But seeing was never as simple as those words suggested. It was an art, and like all arts, it demanded mastery, discipline, study.
"Pain, that too."
R'hllor spoke to his chosen ones through blessed fire, in a language of ash and cinder and twisting flame that only a god could truly grasp. Melisandre had practiced her art for years beyond count, and she had paid the price. There was no one, even in her order, who had her skill at seeing the secrets half revealed and half concealed within the sacred flames. Yet now she could not even seem to find her king.
"I pray for a glimpse of Azor Ahai, and R'hllor shows me only snow."
"Devon," she called, "a drink." Her throat was raw and parched.
"Yes, m'lady."
The boy poured her a cup of water from the stone jug by the window and brought it to her.
"Thank you."
Melisandre took a sip, swallowed, and gave the boy a smile. That made him blush. The boy was half in love with her, she knew.
"He fears me, he wants me, and he worships me."
All the same, Devon was not pleased to be here. The lad had taken great pride in serving as a king's squire, and it had wounded him when Stannis commanded him to remain at Castle Black. Like any boy his age, his head was full of dreams of glory. No doubt he had been picturing the prowess he would display at Deepwood Mott. Other boys his age had gone south to serve as squires to the king's knights and ride into battle at their side. Devon's exclusion must have seemed a rebuke, a punishment for some failure on his part, or perhaps for some failure of his father. In truth, he was here because Melisandre had asked for him. The four eldest sons of Davos Seaworth had perished in the battle on the Blackwater when the king's fleet had been consumed by green fire. Devon was the fifth born, and safer here with her than at the king's side. Lord Davos would not thank her for it, no more than the boy himself, but it seemed to her that Seaworth had suffered enough grief. Misguided as he was, his loyalty to Stannis could not be doubted. She had seen that in her flames. Devon was quick and smart and able, too, which was more than could be said about most of her attendants. Stannis had left a dozen of his men behind to serve her when he marched south, but most of them were useless. His Grace had need of every sword, so all he could spare were greybeards and cripples. One man had been blinded by a blow to his head in the battle by the wall. Another lamed when his falling horse crushed his legs. Her sergeant had lost an arm to a giant's club. Three of her guard were geldings that Stannis had castrated for raping wildling women. She had two drunkards and a craven, too. The last should have been hanged, as the king himself admitted. But he came from a noble family, and his father and brothers had been stalwart from the first. Having guards about her would no doubt help keep the Black Brothers properly respectful, the Red Priestess knew. But none of the men that Stannis had given her were like to be much help, should she find herself in peril. It made no matter. Melisandre of Ashai did not fear for herself. R'hllor would protect her. She took another sip of water, laid her cup aside, blinked and stretched, and rose from her chair, her muscles sore and stiff. After gazing into the flame so long, it took her a few moments to adjust to the dimness. Her eyes were dry and tired, but if she rubbed them, it would only make them worse. Her fire had burned low, she saw. "Devon, more wood. What hour is it?"
"Almost dawn, milady."
"Dawn, another day is given us. R'hllor be praised. The terrors of the night recede."
Melisandre had spent the night in her chair by the fire, as she often did. With Stannis gone, her bed saw little use. She had no time for sleep, with the weight of the world upon her shoulders, and she feared to dream.
Sleep is a little death, dreams the whisperings of the other, who would drag us all into his eternal night.
She would sooner sit bathed in the ruddy glow of her red lord's blessed flames, her cheeks flushed by the wash of heat, as if by a lover's kisses. Some nights she drowsed, but never for more than an hour. One day Melisandre prayed she would not sleep at all. One day she would be free of dreams.
"Melanie," she thought, "lot 7.
Devon fed fresh logs to the fire until the flames leapt up again, fierce and furious, driving the shadows back into the corners of the room, devouring all her unwanted dreams.
"The dark recedes again, for a little while, but beyond the wall the enemy grows stronger, and should he win, the dawn will never come again."
She wondered if it had been his face that she had seen staring out at her from the flames.
No, surely not. His visage would be more frightening than that, cold and black, and too terrible for any man to gaze upon and live.
The wooden man she had glimpsed, though, and the boy with the wolf's face, they were his servants, surely, his champions, as Stannis was hers. Melisandre went to her window, pushed open the shutters. Outside, the east had just begun to lighten, and the stars of morning still hung in a pitch-black sky. Castle Black was already beginning to stir, as men in black cloaks made their way across the yard to break their fast with bowls of porridge before they relieved their brothers atop the wall. A few snowflakes drifted by the open window, floating on the wind.
"Does my lady wish to break her fast?" asked Devon.
"Food. Yes, I should eat."
Some days she forgot. R'hllor provided her with all the nourishment her body needed, but that was something best concealed from mortal men. It was Jon Snow she needed, not fried bread and bacon. But it was no use sending Devon to the Lord Commander. He would not come to her summons. Snow still chose to dwell behind the armory, in a pair of modest rooms previously occupied by the Watcher's late blacksmith. Perhaps he did not think himself worthy of the King's Tower, or perhaps he did not care. That was his mistake. The false humility of youth, that is itself a sort of pride. It was never wise for a ruler to eschew the trappings of power, for power itself flows in no small measure from such trappings. The boy was not entirely naive, however. He knew better than to come to Melisandre's chambers like a supplicant, insisting she come to him instead, should she have need of words with him. And oft as not, when she did come, he would keep her waiting or refuse to see her. That much, at least, was shrewd. "I will have nettle tea, a boiled egg, and bread with butter. Fresh bread, if you please, not fried. You may find the wilding as well. Tell him that I must speak with him. Rattleshirt, my lady, and quickly." While the boy was gone, Melisandre washed herself and changed her robes. Her sleeves were full of hidden pockets, and she checked them carefully, as she did every morning, to make certain all her powders were in place. Powders to turn fire green or blue or silver, powders to make a flame roar and hiss and leap up higher than a man is tall. Powders to make smoke, a smoke for truth, a smoke for lust, a smoke for fear, and the thick black smoke that could kill a man outright. The red priestess armed herself with a pinch of each of them. The carved chest that she had brought across the narrow sea was more than three-quarters empty now, and while Melisandre had the knowledge to make more powders, she lacked many rare ingredients. "My spells should suffice." She was stronger at the wall, stronger even than in Ashai. Her every word and gesture was more potent, and she could do things that she had never done before. "Such shadows as I bring forth here will be terrible, and no creature of the dark will stand before them." With such sorceries at her command, she should soon have no more need of the feeble tricks of alchemists and pyromancers. She shut the chest, turned the lock, and hid the key inside her skirts in another secret pocket. Then came a rapping at her door. Her one-armed sergeant, from the tremulous sound of his knock. "Lady Melisandre, the Lord of Bones is come." "Send him in." Melisandre settled herself back into the chair beside the hearth. The wilding wore a sleeveless jerkin of boiled leather, dotted with bronze studs, beneath a worn cloak mottled in shades of green and brown. No bones. He was cloaked in shadows, too, in wisps of ragged grey mist, half-seen, sliding across his face and form with every step he took. Ugly things, as ugly as his bones. A widow's peak, close-set dark eyes, pinched cheeks, a moustache wriggling like a worm above a mouthful of broken brown teeth. Melisandre felt the warmth in the hollow of her throat as her ruby stirred at the closeness of its slave. "You have put aside your suit of bones," she observed. "The clacking was like to drive me mad." "The bones protect you," she reminded him. "The Black Brothers do not love you. Devon tells me that only yesterday you had words with some of them over supper."
"A few. I was eating bean and bacon soup whilst Bowen Marsh was going on about the high ground. The old pomegranate thought that I was spying on him and announced that he would not suffer murderers listening to their counsel. I told them that if that was true, maybe they shouldn't have them by the fire." Bowen turned red and made some choking sounds. "But that was as far as it went."
The wildling sat on the edge of the window, slid his dagger from his sheath.
"If some crow wants to slip a knife between my ribs whilst I'm spooning up some supper, he's welcome to try. Hob's gruel would taste better with a drop of blood to spice it."
Melisandre paid the naked steel no mind. If the wildling had meant her harm, she would have seen it in her flames. Danger to her own person was the first thing she had learned to see. back when she was still half a child, a slave girl bound for life to the Great Red Temple. It was still the first thing she looked for whenever she gazed into a fire. "It is their eyes that should concern you, not their knives," she warned him. "The glamour, oi!" In the black arm fetter about his wrist, the ruby seemed to pulse. He tapped it with the edge of his blade. The steel made a faint click against the stone.
"I feel it when I sleep, warm against my skin, even through the iron, soft as a woman's kiss, your kiss. But sometimes in my dreams it starts to burn, and your lips turn into teeth. Every day I think how easy it would be to pry it out, and every day I don't. Must I wear the bloody bones as well?"
"The spell is made of shadow and suggestion. Men see what they expect to see. The bones are part of that." Was I wrong to spare this one? "If the glamour fails, they will kill you." The wildling began to scrape the dirt out beneath his nails with the point of his dagger.
"I've sung my songs, fought my battles, drunk summer wine, tasted the Dornishman's wife. A man should die the way he's lived. For me, that's steel in hand."
Does he dream of death? Could the enemy have touched him? Death is his domain, the dead his soldiers. "You shall have work for your steel soon enough. The enemy is moving, the true enemy, and Lord Snow's rangers will return before the day is done, with their blind and bloody eyes." The wildling's own eyes narrowed. Grey eyes, brown eyes. Melisandre could see the colour change with each pulse of the ruby.
"Cutting out the eyes, that's a weeper's work. The best crow's a blind crow, he likes to say. Sometimes I think he'd like to cut out his own eyes, the way they're always watering and itching. Snow's been assuming the free folk would turn to Tormund to lead them, because that's what he would do. He liked Tormund, and the old fraud liked him too. If it's the Weeper, though, oh, that's not good. No, not for him, not for us."
Melisandre nodded solemnly, as if she had taken his words to heart. But this Weeper did not matter. None of his free folk mattered. They were a lost people, a doomed people, destined to vanish from the earth, as the children of the forest had vanished. Those were not words he would wish to hear, though, and she could not risk losing him, not now. "How well do you know the North?" He slipped his blade away.
"As well as any raider. Some parts more than others. There's a lot of North. Why?"
"The girl," she said. "A girl in grey on a dying horse. Jon Snow's sister." Who else could it be? She was racing to him for protection. That much Melisandre had seen clearly. "I have seen her in my flames, but only once. We must win the Lord Commander's trust, and the only way to do that is to save her."
"Me save her, you mean? The Lord of Bones? No one ever trusted Rattleshirt but fools. Snow's not that. If his sister needs saving, he'll send his crows. I would."
"He is not you. He made his vows and means to live by them. The Night's Watch takes no part. But you are not Night's Watch. You can do what he cannot."
"If your stiff-necked Lord Commander will allow it. Did your fires show you where to find this girl?"
"I saw water, deep and blue and still, with a thin coat of ice just forming on it. It seemed to go on and on forever."
"Long Lake. What else did you see around this girl?"
"Hills, fields, trees, a deer once, stones. She is staying well away from villages.
When she can, she rides along the bed of little streams to throw hunters off her trail.
He frowned.
That will make it difficult. She was coming north, you said. Was the lake to her east or to her west?
Melisandre closed her eyes, remembering. West.
She is not coming up the King's Road, then. Clever girl. There were fewer watchers on the other side, and more cover, and some hidey holes I could have used myself from time.
He broke off at the sound of a war horn, and rose swiftly to his feet. All over Castle Black, Melisandre knew. The same sudden hush had fallen, and every man and boy turned toward the wall, listening, waiting. One long blast of the horn meant rangers returning. But two...
The day has come, the Red Priestess thought. Lord Snow will have to listen to me now.
After the long, mournful cry of the horn had faded away, the silence seemed to stretch out to an hour. The wildling finally broke the spell.
Only one, then? Rangers?
Dead rangers.
Melisandre rose to her feet as well.
Go put on your bones and wait. I will return.
I shall go with you.
Do not be foolish. Once they find what they will find, the sight of any wildling will inflame them. Stay here until their blood has time to cool.
Devon was coming up the steps of the King's Tower as Melisandre made her descent, flanked by two of the guards that Stannis had left her. The boy was carrying her half-forgotten breakfast on a tray.
"I waited for Hub to pull the fresh loaves from the ovens, my lady. The bread's still hot."
"Leave it in my chambers.
The wildling would eat it, like as not.
Lord Snow has need of me beyond the wall."
"He does not know it yet, but soon." Outside, a light snow had begun to fall. A crowd of crows had gathered around the gate by the time Melisandre and her escort arrived, but they made way for the Red Priestess. The Lord Commander had preceded her through the ice, accompanied by Bowen Marsh and 20 spearmen. Snow had also sent a dozen archers to the top of the wall, should any foes be hidden in the nearby woods. The guards on the gate were not Queen's men, but they passed her all the same. It was cold and dark beneath the ice, in the narrow tunnel that crooked and slithered through the wall. Morgan went before her with a torch, and Merrill came behind her with an axe. Both men were hopeless drunkards, but they were sober at this hour of the morning. Queen's men, at least in name, both had a healthy fear of her, and Merrill could be formidable when he was not drunk. She would have no need of them today, but Melisandre made it a point to keep a pair of guards about her everywhere she went. It sent a certain message. The trappings of power. By the time the three of them emerged north of the wall, the snow was falling steadily. A ragged blanket of white covered the torn and tortured earth that stretched from the wall to the edge of the haunted forest. Jon Snow and his black brothers were gathered around three spears, some 20 yards away. The spears were 8 feet long and made of ash. The one on the left had a slight crook, but the other two were smooth and straight. At the top of each was impaled a severed head. Their beards were full of ice, and the falling snow had given them white hoods. Where their eyes had been, only empty sockets remained, black and bloody holes that stared down in silent accusation.
"Who were they?" Melisandre asked the crows.
"Black Jack Bulwer, Harry Hal, and Garth Greyfeather,"
Bowen Marsh said solemnly.
"The ground is half frozen. It must have taken the wildlings half the night to drive the spear so deep. They could still be close, watching us."
The Lord Steward squinted at the line of trees.
"Could be 100 of them out there," said the black brother with a dour face. "Could be 1,000.
No, said Jon Snow. They left their gifts in the black of night. They ran. His huge white direwolf prowled around the shaft, sniffing, then lifted his leg and pissed on the spear that held the head of Black Jack Bulwer. Ghost would have their scent if they were still out there.
I hope the Weeper burned the bodies, said the Dour Men, the one called Dolorous Head. Elsewise, they might come looking for their heads.
Jon Snow grasped the spear that bore Garth Greyfeather's head and wrenched it violently from the ground. Pull down the other two, he commanded, and four of the crows hurried to obey. Bowen Marsh's cheeks were red with cold.
We should never have sent out rangers.
This is not the time and place to pick at that wound. Not here, my lord, not now. To the men struggling with the spears, Snow said, Take the heads and burn them. Leave nothing but bare bone. Only then did he seem to notice Melisandre. My lady, walk with me, if you would.
At last,
if it please the Lord Commander. As they walked beneath the wall, she slipped her arm through his. Morgan and Merrill went before them. Ghost came prowling at their heels. The priestess did not speak, but she slowed her pace deliberately, and where she walked, the ice began to drip.
He will not fail to notice that.
Beneath the iron grating of a murder hole, Snow broke the silence, as she had known he would. What of the other six?
Oh, I have not seen them, Melisandre said.
Will you look?
Of course, my lord.
We've had a raven from Sir Denis Malister at the Shadow Tower, Jon Snow told her. His men have seen fires in the mountains on the far side of the gorge. Wildlings massing, Sir Denis believes. He thinks they are going to try to force the Bridge of Skulls again.
Some may.
Could the skulls in her vision have signified this bridge? Somehow Melisandre did not think so.
If it comes, that attack will be no more than a diversion. I saw towers by the sea submerged beneath a black and bloody tide. That is where the heaviest blow will fall.
Eastwatch?
Was it?
Melisandre had seen Eastwatch by the sea with King Stannis. That was where His Grace left Queen Celis and her daughter Shireen when he assembled his knights for the march to Castle Black. The towers in her fire had been different, but that was off the way with visions.
Yes, Eastwatch, my lord.
When?
She spread her hands. On the morrow, in a moon's turn, in a year. And it may be that if you act, you may avert what I have seen entirely. Else, what would be the point of visions?
Good, said Snow. The crowd of crows beyond the gate had swollen to 20 by the time they emerged from beneath the wall. The men pressed close about them. Melisandre knew a few by name. The cook, Three-Finger Hob, Mully with his greasy orange hair, the dim-witted boy called Owen the Oaf, the drunkard, Septon Celadar.
Is it you, my lord? Said Three-Finger Hob. Who is it?
Asked Owen the Oaf.
Not Dywin, is it?
Nor Garth,
said the Queen's man she knew as Alf of Runnymud, one of the first to exchange his 7 false guards for the truth of R'hllor.
Garth's too clever for them wildlings.
How many?
Molly asked.
3, John told them.
Blackjack, Hairy Hal, and Garth. Alf of Runnymud let out a howl loud enough to wake sleepers in the Shadow Tower.
Put him to bed and get some mull wine into him, John told Three-Finger Hob.
Lord Snow, Melisandre said quietly, will you come with me to the King's Tower? I have more to share with you.
He looked at her face for a long moment with those cold grey eyes of his. His right hand closed, opened, closed again.
As you wish. Ed, take Ghost back to my chambers.
Melisandre took that as a sign, and dismissed her own guard as well. They crossed the yard together, just the two of them.